Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host for this segment and one of UNC Family Medicine's wonderful resident physicians, Dr. Caroline Roberts. Welcome, Caroline.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
On our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Joseph Antos, Wilson Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at American Enterprise Institute, about healthcare reform after the Affordable Care Act.
That's some important research that matters about, can we train our brains to want fruit instead of French fries?
I don't think it's possible for me, Adam. No.
Well, we'll find out about polyps and how often do you really need a colonoscopy if you just had maybe one polyp?
We'll talk a little bit about light therapy as being a good and alternative option for precancerous skin lesions.
And then if you've ever had a blood clot or of a family member or a friend, could they take aspirin instead of that blood thinner Coumadin? Is that an option? Well, let's talk then about that very first research that matters about training our brains. I know when I go into the restaurant for lunch sometimes and I'm given an option between French fries and fruit, my first instinct is to choose the French fries, but I really should be choosing the fruit for lots of reasons.
I agree. But there's hope. There was a new article released in Nutrition and Diabetes that studied 8 overweight and obese people who underwent recent weight loss programs, who all had MRI scans both before and after their weight loss programs.
Yeah, and the people who had lost weight had some changes in the area of the brain reward center that made them more sensitive to healthy, low-calorie foods and decreased sensitivity to the higher-calorie foods, which I find kind of interesting. Did the weight loss surgery change the way the brain operates? Or if you could change the way the brain operates, could you perhaps even avoid the need for the weight loss surgery?
I think it shows the importance of weight loss programs in our fight against obesity.
Yeah, I do know that when I do choose fruit, I feel better afterwards. And when I choose the French fries and I eat them, I like them at first, but then I feel guilty afterwards. And I, you know, sometimes think that we just have to really work at it more. And I really commend, like, my children who oftentimes will choose fruit. And perhaps their brains are working better than mine.
Sounds like this is promising, though. Maybe your brain will start to change as well, Adam.
I hope so. Well, speaking of changes, this next research that matters, Caroline, is about changes perhaps in what physicians may end up recommending to patients about how often they have to have a colonoscopy, that procedure looking into the colon with that long tube. That's not something people look forward to when they've actually found a polyp, one of those precancerous polyps, when they had it done. Right now it's recommended sometimes be done 3 to 5 years, but maybe that's not always right. What does the study show?
So this was a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a very famous journal that is popular to all medical professionals, of a study out of Norway who studied how frequently a patient needs to get screened for cancer. They specifically focused on patients that had what they call a low-risk polyp, and that means, you might have heard tossed around, one singular or a low-risk type of adenoma, which is a could potentially be a precancerous lesion.
Yeah, these were less than 1 centimeter, so these weren't real large, and they didn't have the aggressive features. And they looked at almost 41,000 patients over 15 years, and they basically found that if you had had one of these low-risk polyps and you had it removed, you actually had a lower risk of recurrent cancer than people who had never had these, presumably because maybe these were taken away and you didn't have these high-risk polyps, suggesting that maybe these people who've had these low-risk polyps don't need to have the colonoscopy again in 5 years, which is the current practice. Maybe it could be 10 years. I think this is a really promising area of research as we begin to try to figure out how often people really do need invasive tests, and colonoscopy is an invasive test.
This is really important, and I look forward. This is exactly the stuff we're going to talk about with our guest star in just a moment.
Yeah, the cost of chasing cancer. Well, speaking about the cost of procedures and procedures, our next research that matters is about a common condition called actinic keratosis, or these kind of those little white scaly things that people can get on their skin and their faces, hands, arms, usually after they've had a lot of sun exposure over a long period of time. And these are precancerous lesions, and the typical treatment is freezing them off with liquid nitrogen. Sounds kind of painful and cold, and it is, compared to a newer type of treatment with light therapy.
So this treatment is called photodynamic therapy, and the study, which was published in JAMA Dermatology, found that patients that were treated with this photodynamic or new way of treating these actinic keratoses were 14% more likely to have the lesion completely cleared 3 months later than those who had had the current standard treatment with cryotherapy or that freezing solution that Dr. Goldstein was mentioning.
And, you know, it's kind of a tricky thing, Caroline, because there's a lot of economic gain from people who are doing these treatments because these are things that can be charged for and reimbursed for, as can the cryotherapy. And a 14% improvement is nothing to sneeze at. On the other hand, I'm not going to, you know, bank my future on that degree, because it may not work as well in someone's hands who doesn't know how to do it as well. So I don't know. Maybe this is like a good news, bad news sort of scenario, because it may be more expensive. It takes longer to do it. People have to come into the office. They have to get the medicine. They may have to spend longer in the office versus the cryotherapy. It's pretty quick and easy.
It might be a good treatment, however, for patients that have multiple lesions. For example, people who have entire faces with actinic keratoses, 20 or 30 lesions. Imagine how much time that would take with the cryotherapy, one per lesion.
And some of these older traditional medicines that are actually topical treatments sometimes causes your face to be red for 3 to 6 weeks, versus this can treat it pretty quickly. So there are some advantages. I think the jury's still out, but I think it's something to ask your doctor, talk with your dermatologist, ask them about photodynamic therapy as an option for actinic keratoses. What about our last research that matters?
So our last research that matters touches on something that I hear from my patients all the time. What sort of anticoagulant or blood thinner should they be on after they've had a clot or a deep vein thrombosis?
Yeah, we call them DVTs. And it's pretty traditional that people get put on Coumadin, a blood thinner, for 3 to 6 months, sometimes longer. Occasionally now people can be on some newer medications that are perhaps more convenient than the Coumadin. Because the Coumadin, you have to get that blood level just right, and you may have to come into the office a lot to get it measured. So these newer ones, but that you may not need to do that, are more expensive. So I guess they were looking at maybe there's another option.
Well, and it's a good one. It's aspirin, which is common. It's cheap. It's over the counter.
And you don't have to get blood levels.
And you don't. So this was a study that was done by Australian researchers that was recently published in the journal called Circulation that studied a daily aspirin and studied how it reduced the risk of another clot without causing the risk factors of bleeding compared with no treatment at all.
And the daily aspirin reduced the risk of developing these blood clots by 42%. Now, they compared that to a patient taking a placebo, which I found kind of weird. Like, if you had a blood clot, I don't think how you could get away with giving a patient a placebo, like not a real medicine. But in compared to taking this medicine like Coumadin, which reduces it much more than the aspirin, it's probably not as good. But for some patients who really don't want to take Coumadin or can't take it for some reason, it's certainly a lot better than doing nothing.
I agree. So while not a suitable replacement for Coumadin, it seems like it's better than nothing at all.
Yeah, well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Caroline. But we've had a good chance to talk not only about aspirin as an option for some people for maybe deep vein thrombosis, but we've also talked about photodynamic therapy for people with these precancerous lesions.
We've talked about colon cancer and increased or decreased surveillance based on what type of lesion you may have.
And then finally, Carol and I both want some help retraining our brains to choose fruit over french fries.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Joseph Antos, Wilson-Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at American Enterprise Institute, about healthcare reform after the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Joseph Antos, William H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute, about his recent New England Journal of Medicine column about the Affordable Care Act. Is it working?
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Antos.
Thank you, Christy and Adam.
Now, you have a PhD and a master's in economics. How did you become involved in healthcare policy and so passionate about the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I've been working on health policy issues for way more decades than I care to admit. I didn't get into it right away, but in the 80s, I was involved with in the federal government with the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and then with HHS on issues including the Catastrophic Health Care Act that passed in 87 and was repealed in 88, the first attempt to really reformat the way the Medicare program operated. But since then, I've been involved in numerous issues at the federal and state level and for the last dozen years or so at a think tank in Washington.
Well, it's not just any think tank. It's one of the premier think tanks presenting really educated conservative views about policy issues that are important for the American public. Your research does focus, though, on the economics of health policy. What do you find so interesting about health policy? Maybe an example or two from some of your prior experiences or current. What's so fascinating about health policy?
Well, there are several issues. You're speaking to an economist, not a physician, and so my perspective is going to be lean more towards the financial ends of things. But of course, what really matters is not just how much we spend, but also what we get for our money. That's obvious, I think, to any sensible person, and I think good analysis has to weigh all of the many factors that go into health policy and go into the way we consume and deliver health care. My first entry into this had to do with the way physicians are paid. Before the physician fee schedule in the Medicare program was put into law, it was debated in the White House and in HHS, and I spent quite a bit of time debating it with some of my colleagues, from a research angle, in what is now called CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but was the Healthcare Financing Administration at the time, we actually financed the research that went into the physician fee schedule and financed research that went into a lot of the ideas that you see in the Affordable Care Act today. I mean, in truth, there are not a lot of new ideas there, but there are a lot of new slogans.
And what was it that sparked you to write this article in the New England Journal of Medicine about healthcare reform after the ACA? Were you just mad, or you thought this is a place for me to really reflect?
I'm never mad, and I try to be realistic. The Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. It is disturbing to me in many ways, in the sense that there's a good deal of overreaching on the part of the federal government. I think there's an insufficient appreciation for the role of private enterprise in the healthcare system, and an insufficient appreciation for the role of people as consumers and as patients in really making good judgments about the kind of health care that they receive and who they receive it from and how much they're willing to pay. Ultimately, it is true that the government does need to step in and help people who need some financial support to buy insurance. But beyond that, there's real questions about how much is the government helping and how much is the government hurting. And I think we're slowly going to be seeing over the next few years the answers to that kind of a question. Where has the government gone too far? Where has it not gone far enough? Where has it simply missed the point of what I think good health reform is about, which is better value, better services at a price that we as a country and we as individuals can't afford and are willing to pay.
So that's, I think, a critical framework that maybe many, if not most Americans, might agree with in principle. My wife's in also private practice, and I can tell you that there are many aspects of the Affordable Care Act that she, as a provider, is in profound disagreement on. But I think if we were to take a step back and say, when we started this process, there are 46 million Americans that were uninsured or underinsured, and that the Affordable Care Act was designed to have 32 million of them at some time maybe become insured. How would you, if we were to take a step backwards, I know we're not doing that because it's after the Affordable Care Act, but what would you have said? Could you have gotten us to 32 million having more security, having security that they wouldn't have enjoyed? Is there another way we could have done it?
Well, certainly some of the changes in the way private health insurance is sold make a lot of sense to me. The idea of giving people choices, for example, and having them understand what those choices mean, that's a very important idea. Unfortunately, the exchange process has not succeeded in that very well, but the principle is, I think, quite sound. The idea of changing the way insurance companies operate so that the idea of a guaranteed issue that if you apply for coverage that an insurance company has to offer it to you. I think that's a sound idea as long as you allow some of the other rules to make some sense. So if you have guaranteed issue, if insurance companies have to sell you insurance, then you as an individual have an obligation to remain insured on a continuous basis. You can't just go in for 6 months because you have an operation that needs to be taken care of. You have a condition that is flaring up, but then you're going to drop out and not pay for insurance until the next health incident. That's not insurance. Saying that everybody has to buy this very expensive coverage is going to actually frustrate one of the goals of the reform, which is to give everybody access to affordable coverage. What CBO says is
Congressional Budget Office.
The Congressional Budget Office, yeah. What they say is that when the dust settles in a few years, that there will still be tens of millions of people without insurance, and that will. You know, they don't speculate about why that is the case, but it's clear that these will be people who, most of them, it's not that they don't think insurance is a good idea, but it's not affordable, it's not accessible. It's even with the change in rules about how the individual market is supposed to operate, people will still have problems buying this very expensive coverage that really doesn't fit their needs. So we need to give people more realistic choices.
And so as you see this play out, you're talking about we're going to jump forward from this conversation. I'm really interested in how this models out, how it's going to affect access and cost to citizens and keep that high value over time. But we've got to take a break. I'm so excited to have this conversation. I forgot it's going by so quickly. We're going to take a break. But after we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Joseph Antos, Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute, about the Affordable Care Act. Is it working? We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Joseph Antos, Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute, about the Affordable Care Act. Is it working? And Dr. Antos, before the break, you shared from your expertise concerns that you have about the Affordable Care Act as it was passed, and spoke a little bit about, okay, reform needed to happen. We all agree on that, and we all agree that we want a high value of medical care at a reasonable price, and that we want it to be accessible to people. And you shared some of the concerns about access, but I wonder, as you see what we have passed and what's happening, and you play that out forward and model that out, what do you think the, 2 to 5 year impact will be on access and cost as time progresses, on premiums and hospital visits and those sorts of things?
Yeah, good question. You know, part of the challenge here is that so much of our costs in healthcare are really driven by the Medicare program. And so I think a good indicator of how that's going to go is to look at the policies that were enacted in the ACA with regard to Medicare and ask ourselves, are those realistic policies? So with Medicare, the big cost savings in the Affordable Care Act, as far as the Congressional Budget Office is concerned, were very substantial reductions in payments to hospitals and other providers, and implicitly physicians as well, because the Affordable Care Act was an opportunity to deal with the so-called sustainable growth rate problem, which calls for double-digit reductions in payment rates, physician payment rates in Medicare. There was an opportunity to deal with that, and that wasn't part of the bill. So really, it's virtually every provider in this country is affected by these cuts, if they actually occur, and that's the problem. Completely unrealistic. The hospital payments, for example, would be adjusted by what the legislators assumed would be feasible improvements in productivity. But in fact, the kinds of reductions that they put into the law are inconsistent with productivity adjustments that we have ever seen in the hospital sector. So the reality is that Medicare policy is going to be driving costs, just as it always has for the last 50 years or so. And that policy is kind of stuck in old-fashioned fee-for-service medicine. There's always talk about, the Medicare Advantage program and so on, and Medicare Advantage is growing. But nonetheless, three-quarters of Medicare beneficiaries are in traditional Medicare, and that program was really not addressed at all, except for these artificial payment reductions that Congress will allow to actually occur once they begin to really bite. So costs are going to be a problem. And what we need is a new way to finance health care. We need to look at the way we subsidize insurance through the tax system, not just the rather difficult way that the ACA finances subsidizes individual insurance on the exchanges. That is a very cumbersome system, and I think we're seeing lots of problems with it now. But the tax treatment of health insurance that most of us buy through our employers are not going to be able to hire as many people as they would have at that level. They're going to be cutting back on hours for many of those people, and many of these employers are going to have to drop coverage because they just can't make the economics work. So the employer mandate really isn't at all necessary. It causes problems with employment for low wage workers, and I think that'll be the first to go. Even Democrats have been saying that.
So certainly there will be changes going forward. But for the next couple of years, are there certain steps that you think are needed, or that communities and states and can be done at the local level that can help people maximize what we've already passed?
Well, certainly, this raises the question of the states that did not expand their Medicaid programs according to the ACA rule.
Mm-hmm. We know that.
Like North Carolina.
We know that well.
Right. And, this is a political, legal, financial, and moral dilemma, and it's hard to know where one should stand on this, but it is not a no-brainer. Many of my friends on the liberal side, analysts say, well, states are leaving money on the table. Well, that's only partly true, but the fact is that expanding the Medicaid program in its current unreformed structure with states having to go to CMS for even fairly modest changes in the way they run what is supposed to be their own programs, that was an opportunity among many that was missed here. And so it is not a simple matter of leaving money on the table. It's a question of how do you run the Medicaid program in a way that's going to maximize value in your state. That ought to be up to the legislatures of each state. It ought to be up to the experts in each state. It ought to be up to the health sector.
We're going to have to put a bookmark, Dr. Antos, in the conversation here. And I think that the views that you express are ones that at least half of my patients and half the population, this is a really important views. I think you raise important issues. I think the questions of cost and access and reform are ones that we've been grappling with, Christy and I, as providers and our colleagues, and I think we're going to continue. And I think that you bring the issues that we need to hear and grapple with forward. And for that, we're really appreciative, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Antos.
Thank you both.
We're going to need to take a break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. We've been talking with Dr. Joseph Antos, William H. Taylor, Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute, about the Affordable Care Act. Is it working? You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, I'd like to bring back my guest co-host, Dr. Caroline Roberts. Caroline and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
Caroline, if any of our listeners have a question they'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question today about some dry, itchy spots.
I'm in my 70s and have noticed these dry, itchy spots on my shins and upper arm. When I scratch them, they get raised and worse. Some of it scratched off the other day, and the skin underneath was shiny. I've never really had any skin problems before, so what could this be?
This reminds me of it, probably before your time, Caroline, but the Bob Newhart show, and where he was a therapist and was on the show, and someone came in to see him, and he said after, you know, them paying their $80, and after 1 minute of talking to him, he said, I know what to do. And they said, what? And he said, just stop it. And they said, stop what? Just stop it. And in this particular case, I think we've got to stop the scratching, because I think that may be part of the problem.
I think so. I've seen a lot of patients that have what's so-called the itch scratch disease, where you itch and then you scratch and then you itch and then you scratch, and it just gets itchier and itchier the more and more you scratch it.
And that, sometimes in medical terms, we can call that xerosis, X-E-R-O-S-I-S. I don't know how that X-E is pronounced, but xerosis, dry, itchy skin. And we see it sometimes as we get older, sometimes when it's very dry weather, and you really have to get the skin lubricated with moisturizers and avoid soaps, soap substitutes like Cetaphil. And then sometimes maybe some prescription creams. What's the prescription cream you might give to a patient if they have xerosis, if they just need it to break that itch cycle? Anything you prescribe?
I have found great success in just simple hydrocortisone.
Mm-hmm. And you can get it over the counter or get more potent things by prescription. Even triamcinolone, which is a type of hydrocortisone, more potent. So, you know, good question here. And, you know, I think if it scratched off and the skin was shiny underneath, you've kind of scratched it off. The skin, the protective barrier, and now it may get infected, and that shiny area may be the underlying area. And once that starts getting infected, then not only do we're going to give you lotions, you may have to take antibiotics.
It's no fun.
No fun. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm 22 years old, and I've had borderline high blood pressure for a while now. It mostly runs in the 130s up to 150. And I've recently been checking it and writing down the numbers. I don't think my parents have problems with blood pressure, and I don't have trouble with weight. One doctor said that it was unusual for me, being that I was so young. What could be the cause?
Well, first, I want to congratulate you for taking such good role over your own health care. I think it's great that you're only 22 years old and you're already thinking about hypertension, high blood pressure, something that can affect your body for a long time. I think another important thing to look at is the range of numbers that you were noting and writing down. If it was in the 130s, I personally wouldn't be that worried about it. 130 can be pretty normal for a 22-year-old. However, if your top number of your blood pressure, which we commonly call systolic blood pressure, was in the 150s, that is a little bit high for somebody that's 22 years old or 42 years old, and it could be cause for concern.
And you might have this, what we call white coat hypertension. It just means when you come in to see a doctor, or even when you're having a blood pressure check, you get nervous and the blood pressure goes up. The problem is distinguishing that from real high blood pressure, when people get nervous and maybe nervous too much of the time, and their blood pressure, or they're in stressful situations, and you have blood pressure like that all the time. Two other things that I would wonder about. Sometimes younger people are perhaps more likely or don't think about that when they drink alcohol, their blood pressure goes up. So if you drink, like a lot of college students do, perhaps more alcohol than is healthy for you, that could be one of the things that you really do have to worry about. And even though you might have problems with weight, all of us could use better attention to stress in our lives and lowering stress, and it can't hurt.
So I would keep doing what you're doing. Keep writing down those blood pressure numbers. If you notice that they are continuing to be high with all of the interventions that we discussed, then come in and see us, and we'll look for potential other causes like high abnormal thyroid. But I think most likely, with common things being common, it's one of those things that Adam mentioned.
And you can get what's called an ambulatory blood pressure monitor. We've had Dr. Anthony Vieira on the show as one of the nation's experts in this ambulatory blood pressure monitor. You could ask your doctor to do it. And they set you up with a blood pressure monitor you wear on your own for a full day. You don't even have to take it. It takes it on its own and can see is that real or is it that white coat hypertension? Thank you so much for that great question. Erica, what's our next house call?
My husband has dementia and he lives with me at home. It's been hard to watch him disappear from his old self. The doctor said he shouldn't be driving anymore, but he does drive sometimes to the store and to friends' houses. I can't stop him. He lies to the doctor about it, and I'm not sure what to do.
this is really difficult. And I know that we feel that your discomfort is palpable, and the living with someone, a loved one who has dementia and Alzheimer's, very, very difficult. Thank you for sharing that with us to start with.
And again, I want to recognize your strength in being an advocate for your husband and recognizing the danger that he's putting not only himself at by continuing to drive without the recommendation of his doctor, but also the danger he's putting others around him. He could get into a car wreck. He could get lost. He could hurt somebody. This is really important.
I guess since he's not telling the truth to his doctor, he's not telling the truth to himself, and maybe he didn't even have the capacity to do that. I think there's an obligation here to take the keys away. I think that if there are no keys there, and you know, I can be the bad person in this kind of situation. You can make an appointment with a doctor and let the doctor know, and the doctor can say, you know, your keys need to be taken away, because ultimately we're all liable for the bad outcomes that we don't prevent that could be prevented.
And it's okay. You can tell the doctor exactly what your husband is not telling them. Oftentimes, as primary care providers, it's hard to recognize dementia in a patient that we don't know as well as you may know him. So be honest with us. Let us know your concerns, and we will do our best to make everybody safe.
Thank you for what is a difficult issue, a difficult question, and good luck. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a middle-aged man, and I get exercise and regular massage. For the last several months, I've been having really bad pain in my heels and in my elbows on both sides, especially when I'm trying to sleep. It's better during the day when I'm walking around, but it still bothers me. What could this be from?
Well, I've never heard a condition called heel elbow pain disorder, but it sounds a little bit like that. No, this is interesting. You know, if you said it was in your hands and your feet, well, particularly when you went to bed, we would call that
arthritis.
Yeah, and if it was like it was burning sensation in your hands and your feet, we might say neuropathy or something like that. But kind of pain in your elbows, that's a little bit, and heels. It still could be neuropathy, you know, pressure. I don't know, because you're putting those elbows and the heels lying on the bed. There's pressure on them at night.
It depends on other clues as well. We'd love to do a physical exam just to see exactly where your pain is. If you're a tennis player, you might have tennis elbow. Or if you're a golf player, you might have golf elbow, which are two common tendinopathies, or inflammation of your tendon, which is a part of your body that connects muscle to bone.
And you could even have gout or other rheumatologic diseases. We had Dr. Joanne Jordan coming on our show recently talking a lot about those, and there's a simple blood test that one can do for those.
It could be fibromyalgia, which is another pain disorder that frequently presents with trouble sleeping as well. So
a lot of times for foot and ankle pain, I say look at the shoes. You know, you're exercising regularly now. You know, see what type of shoes and whether you got the right fitting shoes, the right types of shoes for exercise. I think you're getting a sense here that we're not fully certain here what's going on, but we would recommend you go see your doctor and really look at a whole host of things that this could be.
I agree.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. But we've had a really good chance not only to talk about some things that we're not always so certain, like elbow and heel pain, but also about difficult issues like dementia and driving and maybe having to take away the keys.
About what high blood pressure is and what are some causes of it, especially in our young adult population.
And then finally about these kind of dry, itchy spots, and boy, better get that skin moisturized and not so dry anymore.
Well, we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joseph Antos, and of course, our guest co-host, Dr. Caroline Roberts. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.